This is another episode of Stand Up Comedy, your host and MC, celebrating 40 plus years on the fringe of show business. Stories, interviews, and comedy sets from the famous and not so famous. Here's your host and MC, Scott Edwards.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another episode of Stand Up Comedy, your host and MC, and I'm very excited. I have a terrific professional comic. We've known each other for a long time, but we haven't worked together much lately, so it's going to be great and interesting to catch up. Ladies and gentlemen, he's clean. He's in Northern California, one of the top corporate comics, and he has a podcast. Ladies and gentlemen, it's professional comic Stephen B.
Hey, look at that. I get applause and everything.
The crowd is so excited to have you here. Stephen, we have known each other a long time, and we were just talking before the show that you've recently, well, recently for me in the last decade, moved into my area. You're actually in, came from the East Bay up to Elk Grove in Sacramento, the Northern California area, and still working all the time. Congratulations.
Well, thank you very much. Yeah, actually, I came from the South Bay. I came up here in 2001. We moved up to Elk Grove, and I'm telling you what, great move. You know, brought my kids up here, great schools, and settled in really well. And yeah, still doing comedy. Had a show last night. It's been a lot of fun.
Oh, that's amazing. And for those in podcast land, I don't bring it up much, but yes, I'm a Sacramento/Elk Grove worker, liver, and raised my kids in this area. It's a great place to raise children. It's not a huge city, so there's still a chance to kind of make a name for yourself. And Stephen has done that. Now, you've been in comedy a long time. How did you kind of end up deciding to become a comic, and when was that?
That's a funny question, because little background. Had a tumultuous childhood without getting into details. I'm not here to whine. But my refuge was always comedy. The Marx Brothers were the first people that really made me laugh hard. And from there, I started watching stand-up comics on daily talk shows, you know. So the kids would be out playing, and I'd be, you know, watching Merv Griffin because, you know, there was a comic on there, you know. And I really became a student of comedy. And then I started buying albums, listening to Carlin albums, and Monty Python, and all of these people just inspired me. So in my eyes, stand-up comics were like untouchable. That was like, oh man, these people are I could never do that, because that's a skill set that only very special people have, right? And that's how I viewed it. To me, they were therapists. And I moved to California in the middle of my senior year of high school with my mom. And a couple of years later, after I got out of high school, I met a girl who I really had a crush on. And she, you know, she had me in the friend zone. And, you know, I figured out there's got to be an end. And one day we were at a party and she said, you know, you are so funny. You should try comedy. I'm like, okay.
That's inspiration.
I figured out, why not give it a shot? So I went to a place that was called the Gold Rush. It was a club in San Jose that was a country western bar that had a talent show. And I went down there with 5 minutes of material, and I did it for the very first time and was booed off the stage. And then I thought, you know what? It was only one joke they didn't like. And I knew it was only one joke, and I was doing really well up into that joke. So I went to, do you remember the Saddle Rack in San Jose, a big country western bar? 3 nights later, they had a contest, and I did the same set without that one joke, without that punchline, and I won $50 first prize.
Woo-hoo!
And there was, yeah, and that was my first lesson in comics. Sometimes you die, sometimes you just win. And I've been doing it ever since. And that was early 80s. Yeah.
Wow, that is a interesting story. And just to go back a little bit, you and I are relatively the same age. I think I'm a bit older, but there weren't comedy clubs per se back when we were in junior high and high school. And it was the comedy albums of Bill Cosby, Bob Newhart, Carlin that exposed us to this art form. But as you said, it seemed like it was an unreachable, unattainable type of art form where, you know, back in those days, I didn't even know where it was coming from, you know. Now being more of an historian, we know that it started in strip clubs and the Catskills, and there was maybe, you know, 40 comics in the whole country in the 60s and 70s, and you know, and then in the 80s when we got involved, it exploded. But that's a great way to get started, doing an open mic and winning. I mean, congratulate. Wait, we should do it. And he won.
Yeah, and I did win. Yeah.
That's amazing. You know, do you remember any of those first jokes?
Unfortunately, yeah. I'm not going to repeat them. I don't want to, you know, make people stop listening. So, you know, when you're young, you do comedy. That's from a young perspective. And, you know, I'm in my 60s now, and I prefer not to relate back to those. I will say this, though. The stand-up comedy of the youth, like, I know I mentioned the Marx Brothers. I didn't mention the Honeymooners, which was another show that I used to watch all the time because of the comedy in the show. Jackie Gleason, you mentioned the Catskills and strip clubs and all that. Gleason started out in strip clubs and started doing comedy, but he was stealing comedy from Milton Berle, which is the funniest story ever. Because Milton Berle was known for stealing everybody's material.
So, I did not know that. I knew Jackie Gleason got his start doing comedy on stage. And of course, a lot of our audience may not even remember him, but he went on to fame and fortune, movies, TV, and one of the funniest guys of the 50s and 60s era. And
talented. The man, he was a composer. He wrote music. You know, the Honeymooners theme, it was his composition.
I didn't know that.
Was brilliant. Yeah. Oh, I'm a big fan. Yeah.
Wow. That's interesting. Well, Stephen, it sounds like you've studied Mr. Gleason, and I did not know he had all those talents, but I knew what a funny, funny guy he was. And the story about him and Milton Berle is so funny and obviously a truism, or because that makes so much sense. Back in the day, like I said, there was not a lot of people doing this. There wasn't even TV when a lot of it started. And so if you saw somebody's act and let's say borrowed a little bit of it, nobody would know.
Nobody knew, right.
It's not like today where everything's on TV, radio, and internet. You know, you can't say anything.
It's very true. That's why whenever I write a joke, the first thing I do is as I document it on Facebook. This one's mine, you know, I got it.
No, that's funny. Actually smart. It's, what's it called? Like self-registration. You have to get it out there. So in those early years, even in the early 80s, comedy was just kind of coming of that, what I call the wave of the rock and roll age of comedy. There were more and more clubs. Were you hitting San Francisco? Were you hitting clubs in the East and South Bay? Where were you finding work?
Well, the entire peninsula was exploding with one-nighters, and because the industry was really catching on. So, you know, people like Mickey Joseph and Tom Kenny and, gosh, the names go on. I can go forever on these names from people from the Bay Area who are all over, you know, from the South Bay to the peninsula to the East Bay to San Francisco. You could work an open mic nearly every night of the week back then and try out your material. And that's how we got really sharp at comedy, because we had an opportunity to keep that machine honed and oiled and, you know, working and editing as each night. Hey, this part of the bit didn't work last night. I'll change it up a little bit tonight. And we all got better doing that. And it was really a heyday for creation.
Yeah.
I remember.
It's hard to explain to younger people today, and there's still a few stand-up comedy clubs, Laughs Unlimited still going, and there's still a few in San Francisco and in the East Bay. But back in the 80s, like you said, everybody wanted to partake of this new kind of, you know, it was so funny because stand-up comedy had been around for decades, but it was just coming to light to like the general public, people that weren't going to jazz clubs or strip clubs. And all of a sudden there's this great, exciting new freedom of speech format that you could share with an audience. And like you said, every bar, every disco, every restaurant would throw a little stage in the corner and have a comedy night or an open mic night. And that was, I think it's great and important that you point out that that was such an important time to learn and build on what this industry offered. Stand-up comedy is really something that has to be worked over and over and over. You can't just write a joke and it's perfect. There's segues, there's callbacks, there's getting the right verbiage. It's pacing, timing, and that all comes with experience. Wouldn't you agree?
Oh, absolutely. You know, you don't do an ice carving for a banquet and make a battleship out of a chunk of ice the first time you grab a chainsaw. It takes years to learn the technique and how to do that. And it's the same thing with comedy. It's a trial and error industry. It's a craft. It really is a craft. And when you take the stage, and if you're willing to take the humiliation of bombing and still want to come back, you've got what it takes. But you,
that's a great analogy. The ice sculpture is a great analogy, but it's so true that you have to, it's much like being an entrepreneur in business. If you're not, you know, making some mistakes and failing here and there, you're not going to succeed. And it's the same with stand-up comedy, that it's what you learn from bombing and creating that callus on your entertainment soul to withstand the different audiences, you know. And that's one of the things, and Stephen, maybe you could speak to this. There's all these different clubs, from Western clubs to rock and roll clubs to restaurants to discos, that all of a sudden were allowing one night or two night of comedy. The audiences were always different.
Yeah.
Isn't that kind of interesting? And that, and we as comics, well, you as comic, I'm a producer, but still, you have to be able to adapt to each and every audience.
Well, you also learn that when you begin actually getting paid as a comedian and going on the road, what you're doing here in maybe a major city in California isn't going to fly in some of these small cities in the Midwest or even Utah, you know, where your perspective has to be a human perspective rather than a microculture perspective. And a lot of comics, I think, who have a great amount of talent and prospect, stay within their microculture and are never able to break free of that, because they don't want to relate to the rest of the world. And you have to learn to relate to all sorts of people from all walks of life, all economic backgrounds, all races and religions and perspectives.
Yeah.
Yeah, and to be able to do that, you've got to make sure that you know enough about them. So it takes, it takes some level of willingness to really learn about the world more and to be more introspective and to be more curious about how the world works. And I think that's how you reach people.
Yeah, and you bring up a good point. We both can name people that were huge successes in San Francisco that never were able to leave because they wrote for the San Francisco audience. And me as a producer, one of the things that I felt Laughs Unlimited provided was when people were coming out from Boston or New York and they were coming to Sacramento, which is kind of like central U.S., you know, it's more middle America. They were sometimes challenged, and Laughs Unlimited became a great proving ground, or what I used to call university, where they may have already had an established hour set in Chicago or Boston, and they come to Sacramento. It was a great place to adapt before you tried going to LA or somewhere where you might have a shot at TV or something more generic. There was a lot of people, like you pointed out perfectly, that could not adjust to that. And yet to succeed, you have to connect with the audience. In fact, I've shared many times, stand-up comedy is a lot about relating to a room full of strangers in a humorous, yeah, in a humorous way. And you have to do that. Now, you've been on the road for years. Any good or bad experiences while touring?
Oh, I've hundreds and hundreds. I want to piggyback off of what you just said. Here's how I put it. Comedy is about taking a random sampling of strangers and converting them into an audience.
Oh, that's and great.
That's how I view it. And your job there is to find unity in a crowd among a bunch of people who may think different, who may worship different, who may, you know, have different worldviews, and making them all agree in laughter at one particular time. It's like sharing a meal. There is a power in laughing as a group. There is a connection that happens. It's magical. There's definitely some amazing stuff that happens on stage. And I can go into the depths of, you know, being the performer and almost like a conductor. And there are moments where you have that control over the crowd, and it's powerful. And it's like, wow, this is a moment I'll remember forever, where you ride the wave, man. And that's when you're killing. That's when you know you're on your game, and it's very a lot of fun. And I'll tell you what, for bombing, most of my bombs have been corporate, because they set you up to do stupid things, and you go, okay, I need a paycheck, I'll do it. And then you know, you get into it and you realize I should not be doing this. Like, for instance, I had a gig in Sunnyvale one time at a fish restaurant where they wanted me to dress up as Santa and act like a drunken Santa. And I thought, this is not a good idea for a Christmas party, but no. They're paying me a lot of money, so I'm going to do it. And it didn't last very long. I was, they were chanting, "We don't like you." And I'm like, okay, well, I guess I ought to go then.
That would be a nightmare, because not only are you personally taking the abuse, but you're representing this icon of Santa.
And the
audience is going, no, we're not buying this.
Right. And I didn't buy it going in. That's probably why it bombed so badly. But yeah, I learned as I grew in the industry of where my audience was and how to relate to them. Like, to this day, that has shifted because culture is shifting. And unfortunately, this world has become little ideology bubbles that set up over regions that you can only say things within these parentheses that are acceptable, and anything outside of that is considered unacceptable. And I'm very sensitive to that. And I'm not going those places because I will not be censored into a bubble think mentality. So there are certain areas I won't work anymore because of that. But that's okay. You know, I've been there before it became that way, and I've had great success, and I've enjoyed, I guess now it's been 40 years now of doing stand-up comedy, and it's been quite a ride.
That's a successful career, Stephen. If anybody that can spend 40 years doing something they love and something that touches their soul and make a living, you're a winner. You're a success. And the fact that we've all had shows that didn't go well is just part of the process. Nobody has a winning day every day. And it doesn't matter what you do, a lawyer to a doctor. I mean, it's all part of the process. But I wanted to go back to what you said about the audience just a little bit, because it's an important point that you're trying to gel a group of strangers into one mindset where they're connecting with that comic and accepting his material, as you said, as a group. And mm-hmm. I think that the challenge is that in those first few minutes on stage for every comic, whether you're an opening act or a headliner, you have to kind of prove yourself and get the audience focused. Now, I was an MC for 21 years on stage, 6 nights a week, 8 shows a week. I've had lots of audience experiences. And then I will tell you and tell the audience in agreement with you that it's so important to get the audience focused, get them together, even if it's laughing at me. You know, self-deprecation mm-hmm. works because you're getting the whole audience to focus on one thing. You're gelling them in that moment. You know, I used to wear, I'm a little overweight, and I used to wear Hawaiian shirts, and I'd get up on stage and I'd say, oh,
I can still see you. I honestly, I can still see you standing there on this on the stage at Birdcage, downstairs at that venue. That was a fun little venue, doing comedy after you showed the Warner Brothers cartoons and the Porky Pig.
yeah, we used to use videos, old jokes and football follies and other things to get, again, it's to get the audience on the same train of thought, to get them focused. And I was about to share that I would say something deprecating because it got the audience focused and all on the same page. And I would say, I'm wearing this Hawaiian shirt and I'd rub my belly and I'd say, I don't hide it. I decorate it.
And it, there you go.
And it's just a simple, quick throwaway. And everybody in the audience was, you know, is immediately seeing and thinking the same thing I'm sharing. And guess what you've done? You've taken 50 to 200 people and you put them on the same page. And stand-up comedy is really about getting that focus, getting that attention, and then telling them a story or taking them on a trip. And good comics like you, and it's extra hard when you're clean, you know, boy, you're making me go off on a tangent, but some people that aren't as funny will go out and, you know, drop an F-bomb or do a dick joke because that's their way to get the audience focused. It's a cheap way. It's an easy way, but it does work. And I think
it works.
The true professional, like you and I that try to work clean and understand the importance and how much more work you can get when you're working clean, it's a little bit tougher job. And I just thought you gave a great analogy and story on that. So thank you for that. Now, you've had all these great experiences. You've had 40 years of success in the industry. Has there been somebody that kind of mentored you or any famous people you got a chance to work with that may have influenced you in comedy?
Well, the very first famous person I ever met was A. Whitney Brown. And I remember at the time, and this was even before I had done my very first stand-up act. This was back when Rooster Teeth Feathers was still the Country Store. And they had a comedy night at the Country Store. And I went there to, at the time, in fact, that was the night, the first night I was going to take the stage for the first time as a comedian. After that open mic, remember that I did the open mic thing. Right, and then I got this gig with KPN Radio, 2 days a week doing a comedy character on the air on radio. KPN was out of the Old Mill up in Palo Alto. And they had a little comedy contest at the Country Store. And I met A. Whitney Brown. So I pulled him aside and I said, hey, look, I think I really want to do this stand-up comedy stuff. How do I do this? And he said, you just do it. And I'm like, well, that was kind of, that was a letdown. I thought, what a jerk, you know, why don't you tell me, you know, how to do it? He says, you just do it. I'm like, oh, this is long before Nike came out with Just Do It. Right.
Right.
And so that was left a bad taste in my mouth. And then years later, I ran into A. Whitney Brown again. And I said, hey, you know what? You gave me the worst advice at the time. I thought you said, just do it. And now years later, I realized that's the best advice you can give anybody. Because the only way you can find out how to do comedy is to do it.
Yeah, it's not something you can really practice. Because, you know, even if you practice your material to memorize it at home, you're not getting a reaction from a room full of strangers. Even if you're performing it for your family or friends, it's not going to be the same when you get out in a room full of strangers.
Your family and friends will steer you wrong every time. I always tell about my wife. I say, I hate running new material past my wife because she always loves it. You know, she's not an objective person. She loves me. She supports me. She thinks I'm funny. Then I go out there and I do it in front of a bunch of people and they're like, yeah, not so much. So,
well, and I think that, A. Whitney Brown, who was a regular at the club and a terrific comic, giving you that advice. And even though you were not happy with it, it was a truism that stand-up comedy is one of those things that you can only learn by doing, I think is the way to say it. And
that's it.
Now I didn't know that you did radio too, because that is a form of, What's interesting about radio and stand-up comedy is they're both forms of audio entertainment. Then even though there's prop comics and guys that can, you know, Milt Abel can, really sell a bit with his facial expressions and mannerisms, a lot of stand-up comedy, when it's just you behind a microphone, is very similar to radio, where you have to use timing and voice variances to sell a concept or sell a story. How long were you in radio? And that must have been really fun for you.
I've done radio on and off multiple times. My very first radio experience was with KPN Radio. And then I started doing promos and IDs for KOME with Dennis Erectus. Remember him back then? And Gino Michelini. And so I met all these people in the radio industry. So I would do character voices. Back then, I did a lot of impressions that were popular. And my biggest one was Archie Bunker, because I really nailed it. Nobody knows who he is now, so I don't do that now. But
oh, come on. We can't hear any Archie?
Oh, geez, yeah, Will, you got to holler wipe me, huh? You know, stuff like that. So
I love it.
Yeah, I had a lot of fun doing that. And I did IDs and promos for them. And then years later, I got my own radio show with Chicago Steve Barkley.
No he way. And I did that's awesome.
Yeah, we did a morning show in Salinas. You know, two Steves are better than one. And that went on for a while. And I've dabbled in radio on and off over the years. I've always loved radio. It's something that always made me, it's always engaged me. You know, the audio arts have always taken my imagination and made me run with it. I was just thinking this the other day, and I was taking a shower and I had a laugh, and I thought, you know who the most lucky, fortunate, and brilliant man in show business in the history of show business was?
Who was
Edgar
that?
Edgar Bergen.
Oh, yeah. A lot of people don't know that story.
Okay, Edgar Bergen made himself famous doing ventriloquism on the radio. Now that is a sales job.
Yeah, and what's so funny was that when TV came along, and he was famous, he was huge as this radio ventriloquist, and they went on TV, and everybody goes, "Well, his lips are moving." Well, he didn't know how to do ventriloquism. He just had two voices, and he would literally just, you know, yak at himself in a funny way and got famous from it. And that's a great reference and a great story. But it's true that radio offers you that opportunity to mold words and mold audio explanations and descriptions to paint a picture for the listening audience. And that's kind of what we do. It's very similar to stand-up comedy in that, you know, when you're on stage, you're taking the audience on a trip. You're trying to share and get them involved in a story that you want to share with them. That's fascinating. And boy, you and Chicago Steve Barkley, that's a great combination. That had
I know, right? Fun. We blend very well together. The only problem with Chicago Steve and I together is that often we make each other laugh so hard that we spend most of our time just laughing. And trying to catch our breath, because we really, you know, we're like brothers. We have been close for many, many years. He was the, okay, I got to tell the story. You're going to love this story. Are you ready for this?
Oh, yeah, sure.
This is the story of when I knew I could do stand-up comedy. All right. So we had just moved out to California, and here I am, this guy from New Jersey, kind of lost, very insecure, had this love for comedy. And my mom is working for a company called Raychem up on the peninsula in the Bay Area. And they have this is the time they had huge corporate events. We're talking thousands and thousands of people outdoors at this event. They've got a stage headlining as Maria Muldaur, you know, and she's going to sing for everybody. And she was big back then. And opening for her was Chicago Steve Barkley, a comedian. I said, I like comedians, so I'm going to go and watch the comedian. And I'm listening to Barkley, and I'm like, that is just the way my brain works. How is he doing this, right? I was blown away, right? And so after the show, I made my way to him. I'm like, man, you were fantastic. And he did exactly what I do today. Thank you very much. Very humble, and walked away, right? He's not going to have a conversation with me. He's just come off the stage. He needs to go, deal with stuff. And I thought, wow, that was kind of rude. Didn't even talk to me. Years later, my very first road trip ever, I'm working for The Last Laugh, and they were my first paid gig, was The Last Laugh in San Jose. And then my first road gig was my last laugh, The Last Laugh up in Portland, which then later became Harvey's. And I was the opening act, and Barkley was the headliner. And Rudy Reber was the middle act. And here we are on the road again. And I shared that story with him, and we've been tight ever since. So at the very beginning of my career, Barkley and I have kind of grown together as humans, and we've been working together for years. I'll probably talk to him later today. As you know, we're like I said, brothers. Great guy. We work very well together.
Yeah. But I think it's interesting, because I don't think he's that much older than us, but that you had a chance to see him perform and then perform with him and then end up being lifelong friends. I mean, what a great transition of somebody that you were looking up to as an entertainer, and then that relationship developing the way it was to where you were doing a radio show together. I mean, that's so much fun, and what a great story. Thanks for sharing that.
Oh, absolutely. And you know, the funny thing about this is, Scott, he's still a great comic. I watch him and I'm like, man, he has gotten better with age. He's brilliantly funny still to this day. And and we both admire each other's abilities. And, he says the same thing about me, but I think that's that. We've become family now, so maybe we shouldn't trust each other. But, I still think he's a great comic. And I've worked with a lot. You asked me earlier if any famous people, too numerous to mention. The last show I worked with famous people was Louis Anderson last year and Kevin Nealon down at the Gallo Center in Modesto. And what a great show that was. It was 2 years ago now. Gosh, time, it flies,
Yeah, that's crazy. But Louis Anderson, everybody hopefully has heard of him. And Kevin Nealon actually got his start at Laughs Unlimited. And then Saturday Night Live really took him to a whole nother level. And these are guys that to be able to work with them, you get to learn from somebody that's like one generation ahead of you and gone through. What's interesting about stand-up comedy is everybody's kind of taken the same path just at different times, and it may be slightly different ways. And obviously just a slim amount get the, what I call the golden ticket, and end up being the Kevin Nealons and the Dana Carveys and the Seinfelds. But still, somebody as successful as you, Stephen, have followed virtually the same path, hit the same boards, worked the same audiences, and it's a great way, especially with the success you've had, of making a living. Now, the last few years have been difficult. I know that you got into corporate comedy and you did really well with that, and which is important to be very funny and very clean. But since COVID, and especially with, what I feel is a real hurtful thing to show business, this whole woke thing that people are, it's not enough that you might be offended. You're now getting offended if somebody across the room, you feel like, somebody said something against them. It's gotten crazy. How have you been able to maintain your industry, your career, these last few years?
Well, I haven't. It has been very sporadic. Yeah.
End of interview. Thank you. Yeah.
No.
It's been tough.
Here's what happened. The roadblock came up. Everything shut down. Right. People started getting very into their. They're smelling themselves too much, thinking that their opinions and feelings are actually true because they feel them. And for that reason, this is how I see it. And I hate to get so philosophical, but I am a person who studies humanity. This is my life. This is what I obsess about because I had to do it with me first. I had to figure out what makes me tick. Why do I react this way? I was very much like these people growing up. I was an emotion-based thinker. I let my feelings guide my decisions. Always a bad idea. People say, well, you got to listen to your gut. Well, look what's happened. Now we have an obesity problem. This is what happens when you follow your gut. No, my point is, though, without critical thinking, without forgiveness and kindness and open-mindedness and understanding not everybody sees things the same way because they can't, because of the way they were raised, because of their personal life experiences, and that we should understand just because somebody feels and thinks this doesn't mean that's right for all of us. You know, we have to be open to these ideas. And we're not in this culture anymore. Like we've got bubble think mentality, and that kills free speech. It means you're not allowed to say this because of some marginalized person. And where I drew the line, when I came straight down and said, okay, enough of this garbage, is when they started telling me that peanut butter and jelly sandwiches were racist, that math was racist. And this is for real. And I thought, okay, this is insanity. I am not going to do this anymore. I am going to start to reach out and try to break that nonsense up with my comedy. So I'm poking fun at everybody, but I'm doing it in a way that I can get by. The problem is I'm not getting a lot of gigs anymore. The past 2 years have been very difficult to get gigs. I worked last night, thank goodness, at the Post. It was a wonderful show. We had about 100 people in there, and it was like the best show of my life. It was wonderful. Audiences need to laugh more now than ever.
Yeah, people are desperate to get out. You know, we were locked down for 2 years. Now people want to get out. They want to laugh. They want to share experiences. And you're right about this whole woke environment where everybody's being overly sensitive. Comedy, just by its nature, is about making fun of life, and that includes humanity and people. And if people can't take a joke, you know, to me, screw them. They, don't go out to a comedy club. But for everybody else that wants to go out, I mean, me as an MC, I'm not a stand-up comic. I was not writing, you know, deep creative material. I would go out and I'd pick on myself. I'd pick on Sweater Boy or some guy's haircut or, you know, some girl having a birthday. And it wasn't meant meanly. It was just a way to get everybody laughing and focused on something we've all experienced, right?
And right. It's about comedy, for goodness sakes. It's not, you're not up there giving a campaign speech.
Right. Well, and you know, then we can go on a whole nother tangent about how everything's politicized, but let's keep it on comedy. So it's been challenging. It's been a tough time. You were doing some corporate, and you kind of related to the fact that because of wokeness, corporate got challenging.
That actually started a while back too. It started to be, before we got on the air, I told you that I was having gigs, a lot of corporate gigs, things are going very well. And then corporate started getting nervous as they started becoming a little more politically correct. And they started checking your material before you went on stage. I had the last big corporate gig was a 3-day gig I had with a big corporation, nationwide corporation, but a local chapter. And they had 3 Christmas shows because their organization was so big, and they hired me to do it. But they edited all my material. So all my segues and punchlines were taken out. And I went up there and basically I bombed because I couldn't be myself. I was too busy worried about offending a crowd that didn't want to see me in the first place. And it occurred to me that the corporate world isn't doing comedy anymore. Now they're so skittish. Now they're backing away from comedy completely, because heaven forbid a person should say something that someone in the back finds offensive. Well, and my take on this, and then let me just finish the idea with this, is I've got my feelings. You've got yours. I can't feel your feelings. Don't make me responsible for them.
No, that's perfect.
Yeah. I'm not responsible for your feelings. You are. So don't come at me because your feelings were hurt. That's on you. That's your brain telling you, hey, you got a little weakness here. You might want to work on it. The world's an offensive place.
Yeah. And I think that's everybody, you know, part of it is that generation of everybody's a winner. Everybody gets a trophy that nobody can accept or take any criticism without it hurting their feelings. And I made a reference to Sweater Boy. You'd have 200 people in the audience and some guys in some goofy sweater. And I would point it out. Well, we all have ugly sweaters. We've all made mistakes getting dressed. But if that guy, you know, shouldn't have worn that sweater, come to a comedy club, paid to be entertained. If he doesn't understand, it's just meant as humor. And what was great was everybody in the audience knows that they've made those dressing mistakes, and they would see the guy in the sweater and they could all join in together. And in this day and age, I mean, imagine somebody like Don Rickles, you know, that his whole career, and he was hugely successful, TV, movies, radio, you name it, but he picked on everybody in every genre, religion, jobs, people, color of skin, but he did it totally as comedy. And if you got offended, you shouldn't have been there. You know, if you were going to
see sweetest man in the world, by the way.
Off stage, nicest sweetest guy. Him and Bob Newhart, great, great friends, great people. But the audiences today seem so many walls up, so many concerns that they can't accept the fact that somebody can go up and make fun of all these different things in a way that's meant to bring everybody together. That's what they miss.
You know, Scott, you know who I think about all the time? You know, I let's face it, I'm a pretty likable guy on stage these days, and I don't do a lot of rough material and don't pick on the audience, but I think about Bobby Slayton. I wonder if he's even working, because they called him the pit bull of comedy. And for those of you who don't know Bobby, he was a Bay Area, San Francisco Bay Area icon that really started to get big. But he was fierce. His whole act was attacking everybody in the audience and cruel. I mean, harsh stuff, but they were there to see Bobby because that's what it was about. It was funny stuff. I don't know if he's even working today.
I did an interview with him. Everybody in the audience, go to his show. His interview's on my podcast. But he's still doing a few shows. He is basically retired, but he gets pulled out of retirement, does a couple shows in Vegas and some of the big theaters in L.A. But you're right. Bobby Slayton would be our generation's version of Don Rickles. He went after everybody and anybody for anything. But he did it again. He's getting everybody amped up. He's talking truisms. He did, you know, him and Don Rickles never told a lie. They're all bringing out what's obvious. You know, if Don Rickles or Bobby Slayton's making fun of the black guy in the corner, guess what? There's a black guy in the corner. It was all truisms, and it was all meant as comedy. Now I know that you and I think similarly this way, but you have started a podcast. Would you share with my audience the name of your podcast?
It's the Stephen B. Show, and it just started. I've got 3 episodes in. 2, it's just me. 1, I'm talking to a friend who I met at a gig years ago, and we kind of connected because we see the world the same, and we're just discussing things. And the whole purpose of this is the serious side of the genesis of why I do comedy, and that is to unite people. We're very disunited in this world, and especially in this country. And it is, in my mind, a tool that's used by government to continue doing what they want to do without us uniting as a group and standing up and telling them, no, you can't do that. You're spending us into oblivion, and you don't have this much power over us. We're supposed to have this power over you. And while we're fighting against each other on our hurt feelings, they're running roughshod over everything that we hold dear.
It's like magic. You know, you guys go fight with yourselves, because while that's, you're distracted with that, we're doing this over here.
Right. So my whole idea is to talk to people about understanding. I'm not preaching to people on the air, but understanding the message of Christ in a common vernacular. You know, let's face it, if we're patient with people, if we forgive people, if we're nice to people, if we're generous to people, if we understand that we don't know everything and have a little humility in life, we're going to understand a lot more about how we all have the same things in common. We all want a happy family, a place to live, food on the table, ability to pay our bills. We all want to be loved and to be appreciated and to be seen and heard and accepted for who we are. We all want those things. These are the most important things in life. And yet here we are spending all our time arguing over things we have no control over at all. Arguing over things that are differences that really don't matter. If we spend more of our time getting together and agreeing on where we agree, we can build that bond so strongly that where we disagree, we can actually have civil conversations and work that out. And even if we never agree, we'll still love each other in the middle of it. That's my goal. And if I can talk about these things as the news happens and as the world implodes around us on a podcast, if I get five people who listen, those are five people that can tell five more people the same thing. And I'm not in it to get famous. I'm not in it to get rich. I really don't care about those things. But I heard something said by a Jordan Peterson that really punched me in the face. And that is, if you have something to say, silence is a lie. And when I heard that, I went, okay, I get the message. So I have something to say, I'm going to say it. And whether someone listens or not, that's not up to me.
Yeah.
And so that's why I'm doing it.
So ladies and gentlemen, check out the podcast. It's new. It's different. It's a great form of free speech. It's not per se a comedy podcast, but I know Stephen, and I know there's going to be some humor involved. So check out the Stephen B. Show. And is that found on all the directories, Stephen?
I'm getting there. Like I said, so far it's on YouTube, Facebook. I've got to get it on all the podcasts because it's a video. It's a vlog, which sounds like a Russian fighter from the 80s. I am vlog. I must crush you, you know.
Yes,
but
with my vlog.
With my vlog, I am going to make it audio and video, and eventually, give me a month or so, it'll probably be on everything where you can find it everywhere podcasts are sold. You know?
Well, that's great. I appreciate you sharing that, Stephen. And I think it's interesting, just to kind of wrap this up, that both of us have enjoyed a unique and challenging and difficult and yet fun industry called stand-up comedy, which I've always said was the last bastion of free speech. And now we are in this, you know, we're in our elder years and we've had all this time and experience under our belts, and it's time to give back and to be able to do a podcast or a vlog and use our skills that we learned in the comedy industry in basically based on free speech, and then bring it out to the public through these vehicles of entertainment is important to not only reach and touch different people, share our message, share our thoughts, but also, again, like back on the stage, you're bringing people together. And that's the goal.
It is the goal. Absolutely. Because when I meet people, I want them to be smiling and to welcome me. And just like you do, you know, you don't want anybody coming up to you with a fist. And if we can generate that energy, you know, I'm going to end my portion of this segment here with this thought. When I first started doing stand-up comedy, the one thing every comic would say to another comic prior to them going up on stage, other than, is that what you're wearing? we just to mess with each other. We'd all say, hey, have fun. And the reason we said have fun was not because we really wanted them to have fun. What we were saying was, if you don't have fun, they don't have fun. So you get up on stage as a comic and you have fun so that they can tap into that and they can enjoy themselves too. It is the key to stand-up comedy. And you know what? It's going to be the key to your happiness. If you're not having fun, nobody around you is having fun. So have fun.
Yeah, that's a great truism. Thanks for sharing that, Steve. And when he says they, he's talking about an audience, whether it's 10 people or 500 people, a room full of strangers. If you don't go out with that idea of fun, you're not going to be able to share with them. And the whole goal is to have them to have fun. And I think that was a great way to end it. But ladies and gentlemen, as always with our podcast, it's not just about talking and interviews. We have some terrific stand-up comedy by Stephen B. live on stage. So stay tuned. It's coming up right now. Before that, Stephen, we're going to be listening for the Stephen B. Show. Any big shows coming up later this year or any projects for 2023?
I have a couple of bookings, and I think I may have that cardboard box under the freeway secured for my living conditions coming up here pretty soon. So that's good.
Also, great. Well, ladies and gentlemen, check out his podcast, his vlog, and keep an eye out. Stephen is still out there working the stages and entertaining audiences all around Northern California. So look for him and go out and check him out. And right now, sit back and enjoy some great stand-up comedy by Stephen B. Stephen, thanks for joining me today.
It is my pleasure. Good to connect with you again, Scott.
Ladies and gentlemen, live on stage, Stephen B.
I hardly ever get angry anymore. Well, sometimes I get angry when I drive. Really, and it's only because of, you know, you people. I'm not trying to put you down. It's just we got things in Jersey you don't even try out here. One of them's called merging onto the freeway. Have you heard of it? This is the way it's supposed to be done. You get in the car, you get on the on-ramp. Hey, here's something special. Speed up! Every now and you speed up some more, you get to the bottom, you floor. Everyone on the road sees you coming. They go, I think he's going to kill us. Let's get out of his way. Then you merge onto the freeway. Oh, not in California. In California, you get on the on-ramp. They're going pretty fast out there. But no cupcake. Catch up to them. Traffic signal at the bottom of the damn on ramp. All right, everybody, we're gonna do this one at a time, okay? Everybody line up with your own individual green lights. I don't want anybody's feelings getting hurt. Heaven forbid the sign should say two cars per green. Nobody reads that. I don't know if there's a car in front of the car in front of me, so I'm gonna wait for my own individual. That's why I flip it. On the road. It's like if you get in front of somebody, they lose. So they're going to make sure that doesn't happen. Hey, I'd like to get up. You're on the shoulder. Let me on the road. I took the shoulder all the way to San Francisco one day from Sacramento. That was not right. Don't laugh at my pain.
Good.
We should drive
together. We yell at each other.
Look at that moron. He's an idiot. That one. Oh, I'm telling you, I always see these white crosses on the freeway. And you know, it just stands out to me when I see that. I go, there, another person died trying to merge onto the freeway. I see those white crosses, and the first thing it does tell me is that Christians are terrible drivers. Well, really, you never see a little Buddha or a little Star of David, right? It's always... Well, you're a Christian, you're a bad driver. Do us all a favor, take the fish off your car, you're making the team look bad.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, that was Stephen B. live on stage. I know you enjoyed that as much as I did. Hey, thanks for listening to the show. Be sure to check out the Stephen B. Show, a new vlog that's out there. And we'll see you next week with another terrific show. Thanks for listening. Bye.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of Stand Up Comedy, Your Host and MC. For information on the show, merchandise, and our sponsors, or to send comments to Scott, visit our website at www.standupyourhostandmc.com. Look for more episodes soon and enjoy the world of stand-up comedy. Visit a comedy showroom near you.